Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, this is Stuart Acuff with Utility Workers Union of America, asking you to tune in every time you can to Bob Carson's Carson's Corner, one of the best pro-labor shows in America. We love it at Utility Workers. We love it across the AFL-CIO, and we're grateful to Bob for coming on and holding up our issues and holding up our principles and values.
I'm Andrew Craig. I'm an investigative reporter and attorney based in Washington, and I'm the author of Presidential Puppetry, Obama, Romney, and Their Masters. And I want to encourage everyone to support, listen to, and talk about the Carson's Corner show in New Jersey, which is a pioneering, courageous, and apt voice for progressives in New Jersey that I first came to know in 2009 when he was the pioneering and virtually unique media outlet willing to take on Chris Christie, dig deep, and look at how he had come to power and how he was misusing it. And 4 years, 5 years later here, that's all come to pass.
Hi, this is David K. Johnston, and you're listening to Carson's Corner with Bob Carson.
Hi, this is Harry Kaysen, member supporter of the Zeitgeist Movement. As Zeitgeist members, we know that it is virtually impossible to find sources in the media that speak truth to power. Well, Carson's Corner does just that, and it is one of those special places where you can find out what is really going on, not just what the bosses want you to know and think. So listen in and hear some truth at Carson's Corner. And oh, by the way, be sure to check out all the Zeitgeist and Zeitgeist-related films you can find on YouTube. We've got a world to save.
This is Les Leopold, the author of How to Make $1 Million an Hour, and I just want to tell you that you'll get a rich and rewarding experience by listening to Carson's Corner.
This is Greg Palast, reporter for BBC Television and Democracy Now, and author of the new book Vulture's Picnic, In Pursuit of Petroleum Pigs, Power Pirates, and High Finance Carnivores, and you're listening to Carson's Corner on 5:30 a.m. Underground Progressive Radio. Radio for the 99%. Help us occupy the airwaves and support Carson's Corner and support 5:30 Underground Progressive Radio.
Hey, this is Frank Schaefer, author, writer, New York Times bestseller. But I'm here today because I've got a new book called Why I'm an Atheist Who Believes in God. And I'm also on Carson's Corner because corporate media is so one-dimensional in terms of the kind of things they cover that they couldn't comprehend a discussion that would begin with a statement that implies a huge paradox. But I think there's a lot of thinking people out there who understand that life is paradoxical, and Carson's Corner is one of those places you can discuss it. So thanks for being with us.
And we are live on another edition of Carson's Corner here on Blog Talk Radio. My name is Bob Carson. Very, very pleased to have you with us here today. And this really marks the beginning of a new era here on Carson's Corner. You know that I've been talking about the election boycott advocates for a long time. If this really started in 2012, it actually started before then, actually in 2011. But Terry Lee, who did not start the effort, but was merely responding to somebody else online, is really, really taking control, I think, and really organized things to the point now where in 2012, you recall, we had Terry Lee on and Mark E. Smith author of the book Consent to Tyranny, Voting in America. I hope I'm getting it right. I'm doing off memory here. That's how we roll here on Carson's Corner. And it really made a lot of waves. The show was banned on the Democratic Underground for obvious reasons. It made a lot of websites. It really created a lot of buzz because even the topic of election boycott, somebody advocating withdrawing from the system, somebody saying, you know what, our institutions are inherently corrupt, and therefore you cannot work within the system, that really brings a lot of resistance from our clearly defined enemies, as in the fascists, the corporatists, the fascist demagogues, you know, fill in the blank. And it also brings out a lot of resistance from those that are tied to electoral politics, the Democratic Party, the so-called progressives and whatnot. And so, you know, in 2000, earlier this year, I think in June, we had Terry, we had Christopher Allen Driscoll on the program. We had Danny Heifung of the Black Agenda Report, a brilliant writer, young, recent college graduate, I believe, who like myself, supported President Obama in 2008 and went from supporting President Obama to an election boycott advocate. Well, now we're actually formalizing this. We are creating a group. We're having meetings each week. We are having meetings where we are discussing various orders, and we're organizing the group. And starting tonight, we are going to have each week for you an hour update, at least an hour update on the election boycott advocates, because that is what we've decided our name is going to be. We have a lot more to work out. And co-hosting me with me that hour is going to be Christopher Allen Driscoll. You heard him on the show back in June. He, I believe, was Ralph Nader's media director in 2008, and he's someone who has a lot of knowledge and is very, very passionate and is really instrumental with the election boycott advocates. And he joins us now on the line. Christopher, is that you?
Hi, Bob. Yeah, it's good to talk with you again.
Oh, absolutely. You sound loud and clear. We're very, very proud to have you on. And, you know, you heard my introduction, and it's really, really great to have an organized effort now, to have some sort of organization. We're getting this off the ground. And as I told the audience out there, this is a very, very poignant effort on our part because it really, I think, conjures up a lot of reaction from everybody on it's in my opinion, this is the ultimate form of dissent here. And we had our second meeting, and you know, just kind of give us your thoughts about you know, what is transpiring and how things are going and whatnot.
Okay, Bob. I have to agree with you. It does seem that there's kind of some electricity in the air about the election boycott. Definitely some buzz. I'm seeing it talked about online, hearing from people that I haven't heard from before. So, yeah, I think it's definitely catching on. Of course, Americans have been boycotting in a kind of a silent, unorganized boycott, but still boycotting in the sense that they have not been voting, been refusing to vote, than just saying, look, there's nothing to vote for. No one that the Democrats and Republicans put up is worth voting for. None of those politicians speak to the daily concerns of working people in this country. So it's been going on a long time as a kind of a silent boycott among really a majority, usually a majority of Americans, not voting and showing their displeasure with the rulers of this country by not voting. As is often said in political science, no group of ruling elite, and I do believe we have a ruling elite, a ruling class in this country, But no ruling class anywhere in history has been able to rule very long when they lose the consent of the people for their rule. And I believe that's what's going on, what's been going on in our country for 50 years at least. And now we're getting to the point where we're saying, hey, we're not going to be the silent majority anymore. We're going to be the loud, militant, active, boycotting majority. So that's the aim of the new group that's that you mentioned earlier, the election boycott advocates. And we hope that lots and lots of people will join us. One thing people can do is go online to electionboycott.weebly.com. That's electionboycott.weebly.com. Check us out. Let me say that one more time. It's electionboycott.weebly, weebly.com. You can go on there, and there's lots of information about what the election boycott advocates have been up to and what we plan to be up to in the future. We plan to really pump up publicity around this campaign. So.
Yeah, absolutely. And those that are listening online, you can also see in the player, we have the website listed in the player as well. I want to go to Ted from Illinois, but before I do, Christopher, I want to read a statement that I wrote, and this, you know, could possibly be associated with our group and possibly be some of the tenets, but I think that, I wrote down some important points here. We believe that our political and media institutions are inherently invalid due to their institutional structure. Therefore, we discourage any and all participation in such and strive to develop our own system of rule and media communication run by we the people. We believe that our consciousness must rise to the point that when we see political races, news, and commentary, anything to do with the system, we rule it out by default. You know, I think that's very, very important because if you legitimately view our institutions as invalid, as I do, as I have come to do. I mean, you know, I mentioned earlier that I supported President Obama in 2008, okay? He was the one, his campaign, Organizing for America, the brand makers that he had. Obama, as noted by Paul Street, actually won a Marketer of the Year award, not surprisingly, but it shows you how good he is. You know, I forgot about that, you know, but Paul Street is great for, you know, bringing up information that maybe you forgot, you know, during the course of the Obama administration. He's great at pointing out the hypocrisy within the Obama administration. But, yeah, he won Marketer of the Year from some marketing group. And what he's done, you know, since then, I don't think I have to tell you, but he has advanced the evil. He has been the more effective evil. I mean, we can go down the line. And this really says to me that because President Obama has essentially been a corporatist and both political parties are beholden to the same special interest and the entire system is beholden to that same interest, that our institutions are invalid. We do not have a real democracy. It is impossible to have a democracy within our current system. And so, therefore, what is the ultimate form of dissent? How do we, you know, invalidate the system by not participating in it? And this really gets people's gall. It really does. This really works people up. I had an argument today with a worker of mine, a coworker, who really believes in the system. And he says, well, you know, we're starting to get independents. In my city, we're getting independents elected. And I'm like, well, it doesn't matter because eventually their efforts will be co-opted. They'll be neutralized by the system and those that control it. And so, you know, why would we keep on doing the same thing over and over again? The great John Dewey, the philosopher, quoted as saying, the politics is the shadow that big business casts on society. And I want to get out from that shadow. And one of the ways to do that is to support the election boycott advocates.
Brilliant. I agree 100% with you, Bob.
All right, let's go to Ted in Illinois. Ted Arendo, welcome to Carson's Corner, my friend.
Hi, thanks.
Thanks for calling in. Now, you're on the line also with Christopher. We're kind of just going over, you know, what to expect and kind of just, you know, making listeners more familiar with our effort and whatnot. Do you have anything that you want to add to what you've heard or just the significance of the election boycott advocates?
Well, what I've heard is wonderful. It's pretty exciting. I've been thinking these kinds of things for a long time. I'm an opponent of the Constitution that we're living under because it's nothing but an oligarchical constitution, an oligarchical political system that we have to get rid of completely. And as you all have been saying, and I agree completely, the first step should be to not participate in it. If you're in a state of slavery, the first thing you have to do is understand that and then resist it in however you can. You can't be playing the master's game, which is exactly what we do when we go out like sheep and vote. And as one of you or both of you have said, it doesn't matter one whit who you vote for. Third parties eventually become one or party number one or number two in this system, like the Populist Party at the turn of the century. It was merged and co-opted by the Democratic Party. The Whig Party turned into the Republican Party. Other parties are just too small; they can't compete. So it's just a game that we're being led to play, election after election after election, forevermore. So we have to stop this ridiculous charade, and that's what election boycott advocates is about. And that's why I'm happy to be a member.
You know, you look at some of the things now with our upcoming presidential election, right? There's a talk about one of the Bushes running, Jeb Bush, and there's talk about Romney, and of course Hillary Clinton is all but certain to get the Democratic nomination. And I think it was Terry or somebody from the election boycott advocate said, you've got essentially two or three families that have been just, you know, woven into our political system, you know, the presidency and you know all the other branches of government over the last 30 plus years. And what does that tell you, right there? Is that it's essentially two families, dynasties that are ruling America. And it's just really unfortunate.
Yeah. Well, we have a modern day version of nobility. You know, the middle-aged nobility. In Chicago, you have the Daleys, daily after daily. We had the Kennedys for a long time.
You have the Cuomos in New York.
Yep. So it's really just a modernized version of the old nobility. It's an oligarchy, an aristocracy, and that's basically all it is. It's no democracy of any kind.
Christopher, I want to ask you, do you think that as it becomes more and more apparent that I want to say the material conditions of capitalism just deteriorate to the point where we have all these problems that we have now in America as a result of income inequality or maybe a symptom of income inequality, do you think that as just it gets worse and worse and worse and becomes more and more apparent just who rules in society, that, you know, ultimately people will be more receptive to the election boycott effort? Because as you've pointed out on this show before, you already have a significant percentage of the American, you know, population that doesn't vote anyway. You know, the corporate media likes to attribute this to voter apathy and whatnot, but you know, do you think that it's going to become just blatantly apparent that elections really are meaningless and therefore, you know, they're going to have to come to our point of view. You look at someone like Cindy Sheehan, you know, who recently posted that she's done with electoral politics because there's really no hope with participating in the system. So do you think more and more people will sort of, you know, gravitate towards us? Because that's what I'm thinking.
Yes, I agree 100% with you, and that's why I'm putting my major effort now into this election boycott, whereas for the better part of a decade, my major efforts were helping Ralph Nader run as a third party or independent candidate. People are already coming to the conclusion. If you look at the statistics, there's a great book that was first done in the 1980s but has been updated since then. It's called Why Americans Don't Vote, and it's by Francis Fox Piven and Richard Cloward. And the two of them gathered just incredible, and I think they came to different conclusions than we have. They came to the conclusion that, you know, that you've got to do certain things to try to get more people to vote. My conclusion is that that's great that number of people have come to the conclusion that I've come to, and that I think a lot of people came to a century ago, which is that we don't live in a democracy. We live in a plutocracy, or as Ted called it, an oligarchy. I like the word plutocracy because it's a term that means rule by the rich. And I think everybody agrees that big business and the rich who own big business really have an overwhelming amount of power in the United States over our elected officials, over our government, over our elections. They basically call the elections. I mean, there's a statistic recently out that says that 94% of the people who won in the last congressional election were the people with the most money. In other words, meaning the people who got the most money from the rich. So, I'm sorry, did you want to ask another question, Bob?
No. I think that's right on. I was just you know, remarking on the statistic that you laid out there, because that's absolutely correct. And what has happened is, since our elections are basically contingent upon raising money, the moneyed interests that, you know, run our elections count on the marginalization of labor. It all has to, you know, the special interests don't make campaign donations just for the hell of it. You know, corporations, after Citizens United, can go into their treasury and just donate unlimited amounts of money. We're seeing now, you know, as further evidence, as I think we move closer, in my opinion, towards a corporate state, a fascist state, what we're seeing is just all limitations on any type of campaign spending is being obliterated. And, you know, you mentioned Ralph Nader. I think this could be considered what he's been saying for a long time about the countervailing institutions being just obliterated as we advance towards a corporate state. And that's what I see is happening, is that if we continue to support the system, if we continue to legitimize the system by voting, and by, you know, thinking that our candidates have some sort of value, then we're only just sealing our own fate, so to speak. Ted, do you have any comment on that?
Yeah, I agree completely. And by the way, I agree with you, Chris, that this is a plutocracy. It's an oligarchy and a plutocracy. And as for the rich ruling, all you have to do is look at a Great Hope and Change president, fundraising for the Democrats. He comes to Chicago and literally has these fundraisers where you have to pay hundreds of dollars just to walk in the door, and then to have a photo op with, let's say, a group of people with the president or somebody else, one of the other Democratic bigwigs here, like Dick Durbin or Pat Quinn or Rahm Emanuel. It'll cost you, let's say, $10,000. And then to sit down and chat with them one-on-one they'll charge you $30,000 or something like that. These are the kinds of figures that these people throw out at these fundraisers. And I, with my small group, Democracy for the USA, have been at these fundraisers leafleting and showing our banner. And it's just amazing. There are lines of literally well-clad people, you know, rich people, going in there and plunking down their money. It's a big money game.
Ted, I was just going to interject. The result of that was Obama was the first candidate for president in the U.S. history that raised and spent $1 billion.
Yeah,
that's a lot of money just for one candidate to spend. You know, it's turning this whole plutocratic process that we've had for literally generations. It's really making it so blatant and apparent that almost anybody should be able to see it. And I think people are seeing it. I mean, back to Ted. To Bob's earlier question, you know, I would say literally half the people now are non-voters, and I think most of them are non-voters because they're sick and tired of this charade of elections that seems to be run by the rich. It's not run by the voters.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, Chris, if I may add, it's more than half the people. A large majority of the people are non-voters. Even a majority of the registered voters don't vote, much less people who don't bother to register. I think the figures are actually larger than 50%.
Yeah, well, especially in a non-presidential election year like this, we can expect only about 35% of the eligible people to vote.
Yeah.
That's a very, very good point. And you know, and we're talking about, you know, Obama raising money and whatnot. And almost, you know, $1 billion that he raised for his 2012 election, a significant percentage of that came from just 27,000 donors. So, you know, President Obama received, I think, this is documented in Paul Street's book, something like $750 million from just 27,000 people. And what does that tell you right there? And then you have, at that time when President Obama is raising, you know, giving his lip service to income inequality and so on and so forth, he's raising money from the very people that depend on income inequality. You also have the Occupy protests. As we've seen here, you know, Paul Street refers to it as an Occupy movement, or a moment, not a movement, because the system is so inflexible right now that any system which remotely or any movement which remotely questions capitalism, which you know remotely questions our institutions, is marginalized quickly by the state, and that's what we saw in 2011, 2012 with Obama's Domestic Security Alliance Council and the FBI infiltrating the Occupy movement and basically disbanding Democratic mayors all across America, disbanding the Occupy protesters, brutalizing Occupy protesters like Scott Olson, fracturing his skull, the Iraq war veteran who's an Occupy protester. And this is coming from the Democrats, you know, our the so-called allies, which is just an absolute joke. And it shows you just how inflexible the system is. And now you got a group like the Party, for example, you know, the Tea Party, I would argue, has really shifted the American politics further to the right, and you know, with the emphasis of deficit reduction over job creation and so on and so forth. And you know, this is what we have in America right now. And I think you're right, Christopher. I think people are really waking up to this. It's going to, my opinion is, it's going to happen one way or the other. They're going to come around to the realization that you cannot solve problems by electing politicians. Politicians are elected to keep things the same. They're not elected to change things.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yep.
We keep electing the same plutocratic candidates who are funded by these billionaires. And so what do we expect? And, you know, I was thinking while you guys were talking, given how Obama came to power and who paid for him to come to power, is it any wonder that he's waged wars against working class people around the world, mostly innocent people? He carried on the Iraq war for 4 years after he was elected, and he was elected on the promise that he would stop the Iraq war. Well, 4 years is as long as the United States took to be in its part in the World War II. It took us only 4 years to eliminate the fascists. And now we have Obama introducing fascism again in Europe and by his support of the fascist government in Ukraine. And then what does the Ukrainian government do right away? It starts bombing innocent civilians in an area where they want to ethnically cleanse the area and get rid of all the minorities from Ukraine. That's one example of what Obama's done recently. Another example is his NSA prison program, where he literally spies on every phone call in the world, every chat on the internet, electronically, any communication that goes on in this world, Obama is spying on it. That's what Edward Snowden revealed to us last year. And what was Edward Snowden's reward for being a whistleblower? His reward was to be driven out of the United States and be a refugee in Russia, looking for political asylum in Russia to protect him from Obama and his assassins.
But
that's what we got from allowing billionaires to choose our president.
And he does that because he doesn't want to suffer the fate of Chelsea Manning, which is a travesty, which is an absolute, one of the most terrible things for that person to be punished for revealing the truth and sitting in jail rotting. Chris, I don't know if you all know, but the Crown family, especially I think it's Henry Crown, the patriarch, who I think was the head of General Electric, was one of the main funders and promoters, patrons, in other words, of Barack Obama, if not the main one, getting him through the getting him started on his quest to win elections, especially the presidential election. And also other supporters of Obama's have been the members of the Pritzker family, which is a rich family here in Chicago. So that's just two or a few individuals that we're talking about. There are a whole lot of others in that same class, the upper class, the ruling elite, who vetted Obama thoroughly. And Paul Streak, in his two books on Obama, I forget the titles offhand, but they're brilliant books. He documents this very, very well. So that's the kind of people, even at the leftmost extreme, because Obama was supposed to be this progressive, this great progressive that was going to save the country. Even at that leftmost extreme, which obviously isn't very, very far to the left, but that's as far as our political system allows, even those people are vetted and put up on this pedestal of theirs by those oligarchs, those billionaires in the background, who have pretty much, controlled them and put them where they are.
Oh, yeah.
And that brings us back, I think, that brings us back to the point that it doesn't matter who you vote for. The billionaires, with the way the setup is now, the billionaires get to any candidate. They buy any candidate. They influence them somehow. They control the media. So if a candidate really isn't what the billionaires want, they simply have their media turn that person into a joke.
Yeah, it's like Ralph Nader said, all they have to do is just change their Rolodexes whenever a political party that's not completely in their pocket enters into the White House or whatever branch of government. They're absolutely correct. And that's the thing. It's that You know, corporations and the very wealthy, they're not monolithic. They don't agree on everything when it comes to social issues like abortion and you know, maybe some other issues. But on issues that affect the bottom line, they have ideological imperatives that they have to, you know, adhere to. And these imperatives are fundamentally anti-worker. You know, they're fundamentally, yeah. And that's very, very important that we have to realize that. And, you know, I look at the Election Boycott Advocates Group, which I am proudly a member of. We're talking with Christopher Allen Driscoll and Ted Aranda, who are both members of the Election Boycott Advocates Group. I think that really the big thing for me at this point, because this is still a emerging group. We're now organizing into a group. Now we're taking it to the next level. We're going to start to do other stuff. But the first thing for me, the most important thing for me, and that's why I really use this podcast, a good portion of this podcast in talking about this effort, is to just raise awareness, elevate the level of consciousness. You know, Christopher, I think it was Christopher or Ted, you were talking about the media, how, you know, essentially the media is used by the elites to maintain control. Well, we need to elevate consciousness to the point where people reject the corporate media based on its institutional structure. You know, for example, if you look at Noam Chomsky's, you know, propaganda model, where Chomsky talks about how, you know, the vast majority of Americans, almost, you know, 95, maybe 98% of Americans work for a living. We earn a paycheck or a wage, and our interests account for nothing when it comes to what is covered in the corporate media. You would expect to see labor newspapers. You'd expect to see, you know, labor stations, since all of us, you know, use our labor essentially to survive in America, but yet nothing. It's the you know, economic abstractions, as Peter Joseph calls them, the, you know, rates of inflation, stock prices, you know, GDP. All of this is given to us as if, you know, these yardsticks really actually measure how Americans are doing, and they don't. And so that's, you know, one of the things I think is very important that we must do. Part of our goal must be to basically make people reject the media because of its institutional structure, who owns it, who funds it, you know, who sources it and whatnot, and search for alternative media forms.
Yeah, I agree with you 100%. I've been a journalist for a few decades now, and I've followed who owns the media. And there was a book out, I don't have it right in front of me to quote it, but there was a book out that basically in the early 1980s, 80 large corporations controlled the media of the United States.
Right.
By the 1990s, it was 50 large corporations. By the early 2000s, it was down to about 10 or 12 corporations. And now, today, it's down to 6 large corporations that control basically 95% of what Americans hear through their radios, their televisions, internet, and newspapers.
Record labels, TV studios, magazines. I mean, they control the entire culture. They tell us who matters. They tell us what matters, and it's like Malcolm said, you know, if they're talking about it, if they're doing it, I'm doing the opposite.
Right, and it's not just the control.
You can never lose with a quote from Malcolm X. He was a brilliant man.
Yeah, they don't just control the media. They literally own the media.
Exactly.
These billionaires and these rich large corporations. So what would we expect, you know, logically, that they would, you know, be true progressive media? Of course not. You have to search far and wide for progressive media, truly progressive media outlets. And there are always these weak little radio stations that you can hardly get, that you know nobody else is listening to, or these little-known magazines, for instance, Z Magazine, which is a great magazine. How many Americans are reading Z Magazine? It's in danger of going under because it doesn't have a large enough base of readers and money coming into it. So that's the fate of the true progressive media. Everybody else, the vast majority of people are listening to pure garbage and reading pure garbage in the mainstream media.
And, that's why go ahead, Christopher.
I was just going to say, even though we've got this concentration of media in the hands of a few billionaires, and the media constantly harangues people about how they need to vote and constantly harangues people with, you get up the last couple months of elections and all you hear on the news is about these elections and about how you've got to get out and vote, and they really pump up the vote. They try to.
Yeah.
And yet, as we say, a majority of people are not voting. So a majority of people still know, even though we've got this lousy media that lies to them, people know that there's something rotten in Denmark. People know that there's something rotten with this whole system. And people, you ask the average person, you say, do you agree with the statement that the super wealthy and big businesses control and have way too much control over our government? I'd say something like 90% of the people will say yes. People know.
And one of the things about voting, and this is very, very tricky, and this is what the elites do, is they point to the fact that, particularly over the Obama administration, we've seen a rollback in voter rights, right? We've seen the Supreme Court essentially gut a key provision of the Voting Rights Act of 1964, I think Section 5. We've seen, various states try to, implement voter ID laws that are intended to reduce the voting populace. As Paul Rayrick, the founder of ALEC, American Legislative Exchange Council, said, our leverage in the election goes up as the voting populace goes down, and that's great. But what happens is, Chris and Ted, is the Terry pointed this out, that the establishment airs, clips of, or they'll air stories about the Voting Rights Act and the Freedom Summer and so on and so forth as an example of how important it is to vote, when in actuality, it's completely meaningless to begin with. It's like they use, previous struggles to justify the current system when, in actuality, the current system is completely corrupted and working with, in the system is just useless. So I almost feel like, these efforts on the part of Republicans are used by, the larger political establishment to just further try to legitimize the system.
Yeah, and I was going to say also, getting people out to vote, this mantra of herding people to the polls is unfortunately not only on the right and not only in the pure mainstream media, it's also something that the quote-unquote progressive media, much of it, promotes. For instance, WCPT, this local,
right.
It's called Progressive Talk here
yeah.
in Chicago. It has a lineup of hosts, host, radio hosts, who are constantly drumming up the get out the vote business message. Tom Hartman, Jeff Santos.
Yeah.
I mean, hour after hour, if you listen to CPT all day long, that's what will be drummed into your head, that you have to get out and vote. So they're saying, go out and vote for left Democrats, vote for progressives, vote for, whoever, right? And so they're pushing that whole thing too. The ill-informed leftists, so-called
yeah.
leftists.
And what's really, really unfortunate too. You mentioned some of these progressive. That's where I like to focus a lot of my attention, because you look at Fox News and you look at right-wing talk radio. They are our clearly defined enemies. I mean, these institutions like Right Wing Talk Radio, Fox News, which I think you can make an argument that Fox News is almost a fascist network, or it's bordering on fascism. There's, as is the Republican Party. Okay, yeah, we get that. We understand that they want to, completely turn the state over to corporate America, and they want to have a libertarian paradise. But you look at some of these MSNBC hosts, some of these progressive hosts. Take someone like Ed Schultz, for example. Here is a perfect illustration of how our system is completely flawed, how there's really no distinction between the two. Ed Schultz, not too long ago on his, I think it was his radio show, spoke about how, he was offered to, one of the Fox News hosts offered to buy him a drink at a bar, and he refused and whatnot. And so, at the end of the day, these people, gather at the same restaurants. They go to the same parties. They go to the same functions. They're there to uphold the system because the system has really rewarded them. And there's not much difference between any the way I look at it, not much difference between any MSNBC host or any Fox News host. And so, therefore, you should reject both of them because, both MSNBC or Fox News hosts, they didn't grow up, from the ground up. They were like Obama, introduced to elite institutions, just trying to uphold the system. And at the end of the day, as Brad Hullhut from Pinko the Bear Radio has said on this program, they're eating at the same table at the nation's oligarchs. And therefore, we should really consider them invalid.
Yeah, I think people need to think. People need to think about this from the point of view of how this is a game being played on us. They have the really, really terrible right wing that are, as you say, as close to fascists as we come in the United States, and then you have these much more reasonable, progressive, liberal people, and yet, when you elect a progressive liberal like Barack Obama went around in 2008 and 2012 telling people he was a progressive. He used the word several times. And what do you get? You don't get what progressives expect. What progressives expect is a better deal for the working person. What progressives expect is a less warlike, imperialist United States. You don't get that from Obama. You get the exact opposite of that. You've got Obama, basically, the one promise Obama made to the labor movement in 2008 was that he would pass a card check bill that would make it easier to organize working people into unions. And one of the first things he did was put that on the back burner, and it's still on the back burner. He still hasn't passed it.
Oh, yeah, and he went after union pensions. He supported the firing of Rhode Island teachers. And Obama, he appointed a finance guy to head the GM. You can go down the down the line, issue after issue.
He froze government workers' wages for 3 years. Imagine in a time of inflation. You got to sit there with the same wage for 3 years, not going up as inflation goes up, eating away. So, in other words, Obama gave all federal workers a reduction in pay.
And you know what? You know what's funny, Christopher? If you talk to the most ardent Obama supporter, right, it almost reminds me of Ronald Reagan. Ronald Reagan understood the importance of slogans, right? I mean, Ronald Reagan, in actuality, raised taxes 11 times, tripled the national debt. But no, he was a fiscal conservative, no matter what he did, to conservatives. Well, you look at someone like, and I don't even like to use those terms, conservatives, liberals, but, for the purposes of discussion. Well, if you talk to the most ardent Obama supporter and say, Obama actually recommended cutting Social Security. His market-based calculations would have cost, the chain CPI would have cost Social Security recipients 2% of their income. Obama offered to means test Medicare. You know, Obama did all these things with the grand bargain, as Paul Street calls it. They wouldn't believe it. No, what are you talking about? President Obama, he's our ally. It's really, people are so tied in to the political establishment known as Obama that they can't see reality, no amount of evidence. So in that sense, a lot of times when you're talking to Obama supporters, they're not that much different from the Tea Party folks.
No, they're exactly the same. They're robotic. They listen. They don't look at what's going on, what Obama's actually doing. They only listen to the propaganda that he puts out to give a certain perception of what he's doing, and that's where they get their ideas from. And that's why, you know, to tell you the truth, the 20% of people in the United States who self-identify as liberals, progressives, I usually don't pay much attention to them, because I know that there's this big, broad 60% of people out there, the non-voters, who don't think that way, who don't listen to foolishness and believe it, who don't listen to lies and believe it, who don't listen to Obama's propaganda, but look at what Obama's doing. And that's why only 40% in America today are even give Obama good grades. I mean, 60% give Obama bad grades for what he's doing. And we know, we mentioned this in the last time we were on, that only 7% give Congress a passing grade. Only 7% support what Congress is doing today, and so what is that? 93% are opposed.
Yeah.
So yes, it really is frustrating when you see these kind of people who just are robotic in the way they swallow Obama's propaganda and the Democratic Party's propaganda and the Republican Party's propaganda. But it's nice to know that they're the minority, and we, the non-voter, are the majority. We are the people who've already figured out this is a game being played on us. This is a joke, and we're the butt of the joke, and we're not putting up with it anymore.
Well said, Ken.
I agree, Chris, completely. People, Americans have to understand, and as Chris is saying, a lot of them already implicitly understand, maybe not in highfalutin theoretical terms, but we have a power elite in this country. C. Wright Mills wrote a brilliant book. That was the title of it, The Power Elite. And what he described was a ruling club, and this ruling club is not monolithic. It wouldn't serve their purpose for them to all be identical. You have to have two wings of this property party to alternate, to play good cop and bad cop. So the Democrats serve this purpose or play this role excellently. Obama and a whole bunch of other elites fit into this club, and we have to understand that.
Idea of good cop, bad cop is the perfect analogy for what's going on with the Democrats and Republicans.
We're still
in jail, but it's good cop, bad cop.
Right.
Yeah, and you know what? There's a whole host of social problems. I mean, when it comes down to it, it's impacting our health. I mean, the system of labor control that we have in America that is perpetuated by both political parties is just it's killing us. I mean, it's the system of capitalism, I think, too, which we routinely question. But I want to kind of get your reaction to this, because I had a discussion with somebody who was actually part of one of our groups on Facebook, but I think he ultimately left, or he said he was banned. I'm not sure what happened. But his name is Michael. And, I was talking to him, and he said, well, we have to get more people like Bernie Sanders in. We have to get more people like I can never pronounce her name, the Seattle Socialist Council worker, Swami I can't pronounce her name, but
Sawant is her last name.
Yeah, yeah.
So long.
We have to get more people like that, you know, and therefore then we can really enact change. And, you know, what's your response to that? Because I just think that history doesn't work. History says the opposite, and ultimately the system says the opposite as well.
Well, my response is that Obama was, you know, that guy who was supposed to change everything, and Clinton was that guy who was supposed to change everything, and Carter was the guy who was supposed to change anything and everything, and Johnson was the guy who was supposed to change everything, and Kennedy was the guy who was supposed to change everything, and look where we're at.
Yeah, actually, Chris, I remember very clearly when Clinton was elected, he was going to change the whole country. He was going to change the world. He was going to give us back all this, the peace dividend, because he was going to, well, I guess the Cold War had just ended anyway, so we were supposed to be getting all this prosperity, quote-unquote defense budget, in other words, the military budget, was supposed to go down drastically. It didn't go down, I don't think, at all, certainly not significantly. So he was a big bust. And so, yeah, I agree completely. And I was thinking also to depend on some great Democrat to vote for some miracle candidate. It's kind of like black slaves in the 1850s talking about getting a good white master. It's ludicrous. Or people in the Middle
Ages. It really is.
Or people in the Middle Ages hoping to get a good king. Well, as a matter of fact, sometimes you did get kings that were less bad and less tyrannical than others that did some good things, but they were still kings. And, you know, eventually people understood that we can't have kings. We can't have this system. People eventually understood that we can't have masters and slaves. We can't have people owning other people. So eventually people today in the modern era will understand that we can't be having these quote-unquote representatives, which is the most ludicrous name you could give these people, because they don't represent anybody but the billionaires and the millionaires. We can't have this system. It is totally unacceptable.
Yeah, I think
absolutely.
That's a brilliant way of putting it, because, you know, it's like the slaves knew they were slaves. You know, we had a tiered system where you know serfs knew they were serfs and so on and so forth. Well, you know, today, and the polls really reflect this, that a significant percentage of Americans believe that they're temporarily inconvenienced millionaires, and that's unfortunate. That has to do with in large part the corporate media, which sells the idea of the American dream. But your point is well taken, is that a king or a slave master and whatnot is not going to deliver any type of value for society. It's a very, very good point. We're kind of almost at the top of the hour here, and I want to just focus on we had a second meeting today, and it went well, and you know, we've decided, I think, on a name and some other initiatives that are going to take place. And so I kind of want to turn it over to you, Christopher, and just tell, you know, everybody what to expect, what we're going to be doing kind of in the next week or so, and tell people how they can ultimately join the group.
Okay, I already went over the website. People should also know, if they're on Facebook, they can go to do a search for Election Boycott Advocates and find us and join our Facebook discussion group. And that's where we basically invite anybody and everybody. We don't. That's a group that it doesn't have all election boycott advocates, but there are other people that come and criticize us and challenge what we say, and we try to reasonably answer them. So I'd really urge people, do a search on Facebook for Election Boycott Advocates and join up on our discussion group. We've got a group of a couple dozen people from around the country who are getting together, as Bob said earlier, to try to make this silent, unconscious boycott that's been going on for half a century into a loud, militant boycott, a boycott that says, hey, we don't agree with your rule. The wealthy elite and the big businesses that are ruling now, we're going to be getting together plans for how to publicize that more. And if anyone out there has methods that they can suggest to us on how to publicize, please get in touch with us. We're talking about launching a campaign that basically announces our existence on Election Day, this coming November. So we're organizing towards that. We're organizing to get together documents that explain in straightforward language what we stand for and why we're doing this boycott. I think we've come to the conclusion that we're saying basically, why are we boycotting? We're boycotting to build democracy. We don't have democracy now. Most people agree with that. And we're striving towards creating a real democracy. And that's why, for us, the first step is to stop participating with the phony elections that we have today, with the elections that only ever return plutocrats and people who have already been bought off and paid in basically legal bribes, which we call campaign donations, but they're really legal bribes. It's a form of bribery where the well-to-do bribe the politicians to do their bidding and to run against those of us who are working class people who work for a living. So that gives you an idea of the direction we're going in. Basically, we see ourselves as an educational resource at the moment, but hopefully we'll move towards organizing citizens in other ways as well.
Ted?
Yeah, I just want to add one little thing to what Chris said. Another Facebook page is Boycott Election, and that's four words, Boycott Election. That's the web page of one of our members, and that's the one actually that I communicate on. And if you become friends with that person, then you can communicate with us as well. So I just wanted to add that.
Well, listen, guys, I hope that this is the beginning of a new chapter here. I hope that we can meet on the air every single week to discuss these issues and our current progress and, you know, have a way to interact with people out there listening, because I think, honestly, this is so important what we're doing right now. I can't even begin to describe how important I feel this effort is. It's really, you know, incumbent upon us to, I think, educate the people out there and, you know, take it one step at a time. The first step, I think, is educating the people, raising awareness, elevating people's consciousness about some of the things that we've been speaking about over the last hour or so. And I think inevitably people will fall into our camp, and we just got to use the tools at our disposal. We got to network with people that are of like-minded people. We've got to get the word out there and ultimately change things. But the first step is, you know, get people to acknowledge that the system is just, corrupt and cannot be worked with at all. So you got to disengage. So it's been great. I know we could probably speak for another hour or so, because all of us are so passionate about these issues. But I want to thank Christopher Allen Driscoll and Ted Aranda for calling into Carson's Corner here. And like I said, hopefully we'll do this every week and have a real vibrant discussion about these issues.
Thank you, Bob.
Thanks, Bob. Thanks, Chris.
Take care, guys. Thank you very much for appearing on Carson's Corner. And we'll be right back after this message, folks.
got no car, so I got no soul. Life is prison, no parole, no control. Food, I got my number on a wiretap. Cause I jacked for Civilac. Fuck a Cadillac, so fine. One motive, no focus. Every sidewalk, I'm off, it's like a tightrope. Yes, I know my deadline, sire. With my life is fire, I'm sending me the sound under the barbed wire. The mother of my John, I lose her mind at my grave. It's my life for that life, so call it a free trade.
Now, there's one thing you might have noticed I don't complain about. Politicians. Everybody complains about politicians. Everybody says they suck.
Yeah.
Well, where do people think these politicians come from? They don't fall out of the sky. They don't pass through a membrane from another reality. They come from American parents and American families, American homes, American schools, American churches, American businesses, and American universities, and they're elected by American citizens. This is the best we can do, folks. This is what we have to offer. It's what our system produces. Garbage in, garbage out. If you have selfish, ignorant citizens, you're going to get selfish, ignorant leaders. And term limits ain't going to do you any good. You're just going to wind up with a brand new bunch of selfish, ignorant Americans. So maybe it's not the politicians who suck. Maybe something else sucks around here. Like the public. Yeah, the public sucks. There's a nice campaign slogan for somebody. The public sucks. Fuck hope. Fuck hope. Because if it's really just the fault of these politicians, then where are all the other bright people of conscience? Where are all the bright, honest, intelligent Americans ready to step in and save the nation and lead the way? We don't have people like that in this country. Everybody's at the mall, scratching his ass, picking his nose, taking his credit card out of his fanny pack and buying a pair of sneakers with lights in them. So I have solved this little political dilemma for myself in a very simple way. On election day, I stay home. I don't vote. Fuck 'em. Fuck 'em. I don't vote. Two reasons I don't vote. First of all, it's meaningless. This country was bought and sold and paid for a long time ago. The shit they shuffle around every 4 years doesn't mean a fucking thing. And secondly, I don't vote because I believe if you vote, you have no right to complain. People like to twist that around, I know. They say, well, if you don't vote, you have no right to complain. But where's the logic in that? If you vote and you elect dishonest, incompetent people, and they get into office and screw everything up, well, you are responsible for what they have done. You caused the problem. You voted them in. You have no right to complain. I, on the other hand, who did not vote, in fact, did not even leave the house on election day, am in no way responsible for what these people have done and have every right to complain as loud as I want about the mess you created that I had nothing to do with. So I know that a little later on this year you're going to have another one of those really swell presidential elections that you like so much. You'll enjoy yourselves. It'll be a lot of fun. I'm sure as soon as the election is over, your country will improve immediately. As for me, I'll be home on that day doing essentially the same thing as you. The only difference is when I get finished masturbating, I'm going to have a little something to show for it, folks. Thank you very much.
Hi, this is Frank Schaefer, author of Sex, Mom, and God. You're listening to Carson's Corner, a show I enjoy. I hope you enjoy it, too. I encourage you to listen.
We're back here on Carson's Corner. Big thanks to Christopher Allen Driscoll and Ted Aranda for calling and discussing the election boycott effort. We are now called the Election Boycott Advocates. Very, very important stuff. Keep it right here on Carson's Corner and visit the websites that Christopher mentioned and get involved. Get active, folks. You know, because we were talking about Bill Clinton. I think Ted brought up Bill Clinton and how, you know, Bill Clinton was supposed to be the savior. He's supposed to change things. And you know, Christopher rattled off all these different presidents who were supposed to change things, and you know, these guys were, you know, trying. There were, you know, in trying times, and so on. And you know, you look at Bill Clinton, and actually, people don't realize just how corporate Bill Clinton was. Bill Clinton was the head of the New Democrats, the DLC, right? And he really took the government and made it work on behalf of the special interest. And he did this by obliterating welfare. You know, one of the things that I think is Barbara Einright, the author of the book Nickel and Dimed, mentioned was that in the United States of America, we don't have a social safety net, okay? We have really no social safety net. It's been withered away. And this has happened primarily at the hands of Democrats. If you look at what Bill Clinton did, where he declared that the era of big government is over, okay, and he essentially ended welfare, made it no longer permanent, and as a result of Clinton's, you know, anti-welfare stance and his teaming up with Newt Gingrich to, quote, reform welfare, which put a lot of people into voluntarism. You recall that you know, hypocritical program that, Bill Clinton announced to the American people how, you know, instead of getting people, making people, quote, reliant on the government, you're going to push them into this voluntarism where they're going to, you know, it was, and he had draconian cuts to the welfare budget. Well, we don't have a system, a social safety net in America. I mean, unemployment benefits now have become political, where you pay into unemployment benefits and you're lucky if they're extended past 6 months. In fact, our Congress, despite the fact that we have a still a high unemployment rate. In many, many states, we have above national average unemployment. We have a shadow unemployment rate, which God knows where that is. It's much higher than the official unemployment rate. Unemployment benefits have become part of the cycle of disinvestment because the wealthy view unemployment as a minority-driven program, as a symbol of government abuse, just like welfare, right? Welfare is highly politicized because it's viewed as a symbol of government abuse, mainly going to minorities, which, of course, we know is not true. But, you know, if you're lucky, you'll get 6 months of unemployment benefits, even though you've paid into the unemployment system your entire life. As we told you, welfare in America, the average welfare recipient gets $4.39 of welfare benefits, which is absolutely just nothing. Okay, you try to live off of $4.39 a day. In fact, last year, several members of Congress tried to live off of welfare stamps, welfare benefits, and they couldn't do it. It was just an absolute joke. Medicare, you know, Medicaid has been, you know, the corporate state has went after Medicaid. They profit off of both the, quote, left side and right side of the state. And so, you know, right now in America, you're about six times more likely to go into poverty than you are to become rich because we don't have a social safety net. The wealthy do not want a social safety net to exist. The wealthy do not want their tax dollars going to minorities, going to, you know, as Mitt Romney said, people that can't take personal responsibility. Everything is about individual initiative. You know, it's all about it all comes down to, you know, what you do and the choices you make. Everything is the result of personal choices. And so, you know, we don't have anything anymore because people support the Democrats, because, you know, people do not call Bill Clinton or Barack Obama what they really are, the more effective evil. Okay, these individuals have no attachment to working folks, okay? They're there to advance a corporate agenda. And you want to talk about, you know, deregulation, okay? Regulation being law and order in America. You want to talk about deregulation? Well, Bill Clinton, if you look at what Clinton did during his administration, he was instrumental in deregulation of Wall Street. You had Larry Summers. You had Alan Greenspan. You had Robert Rubin, who was a Clinton advisor and former head of, I think, Citigroup or Citibank. He was lobbied away from his government post to help in the deregulation of Wall Street. And Bill Clinton, actually, this is documented by William Black in one of William Black's book. Bill Clinton and Al Gore famously told regulators to not even consider bringing any type of fraud cases against Wall Street. Don't even think of Wall Street as customers. Now, this is, you know, federal regulators that the Clinton administration was telling to consider customers. Now, could you imagine a crook, you know, telling a cop to, or a cop telling another cop, consider this crook your customer? You know, this is the sick society that we have. Right, and it was Clinton. Clinton emphasized Wall Street over Main Street, and as a result, we have a financial system that is completely out of whack. And as Dick Durbin, the politician, said, quite frankly, they own the place, and they absolutely do own the place. And now you look ahead to 2016. Well, who's going to run on the Democratic side, right? Who's going to run? Who's going to have this historic campaign, right? The first female presidential candidate, I believe. I maybe there was. Who cares? Does it matter? Does it matter if there was a female presidential candidate? Does the office of the presidency matter anymore? No, of course not. Does it matter? But you're going to have Hillary Clinton, who, you know, again, was right there when Wall Street was deregulated, is no friend of organized labor. It's just a disgusting politician, as Ralph Nader says, you know, we have lords and masters, and you might as well call her Lord Clinton. You know, what's the difference? It's just, it really speaks volumes about our system and how voting should not even be considered anymore. It shouldn't be considered. It is absolutely meaningless. It is absolutely useless. And then some of the Democrats out there, some of the Obama supporters, oh, well, yeah, what if you let them get in, they're going to privatize this, they're going to privatize that. Look, the business community wants to privatize Social Security. They want to privatize Medicare. They want to move us towards a fascist country. So what difference does it make? You know, when you vote for one of the two evils, you're voting for evil in the end. And that's what we see in America. You know, so, you know, I say let the Republican, who cares? You know, if elections don't matter and you believe that the material conditions of capitalism will deteriorate to the point where Americans want change, they want something different. You know, I thought this would have occurred after 2008, the financial collapse. You would have thought that there would have been an alternative to capitalism. In the 1930s, arguably after the Great Depression, there were alternatives. I mean, you had socialists like Norman Thomas, you had FDR, and you had the spread the wealth crowd, but there was alternatives out there, and you had political movements, and you had a labor movement, and you had labor law passed, and you had things like the Wagner Act, and there was almost a truce between capital and labor, and from that point on, you had the birth of the middle class. You had, a sharp reduction in income inequality. But those days are gone right now. You know, those days are, and those days are never going to come back. And even if they do come back, even if, let's say, we replace all the fascist-like policies, the pro-business policies that have been ruling our existence over the last 30-plus years, and let's say you replace it with more labor-friendly legislation, let's say we completely redo the government, well, what's going to happen? What's going to happen is the elites will always be able to regain control. There may be a slow in the economy. There may be some sort of lull. There may be some sort of economic panic. And guess what? The alternative, from the standpoint of the elites, is to undo all this anti-business legislation. Let's run America like a business again. And that's how the elites take control all over again, because they own everything. They own the media. They own the politicians. They own the land. They own everything, these individuals. And so, therefore, as long as we keep on legitimizing the system, as long as we keep on voting, we're never going to experience any different results. And, look, I'm not going to say that I know the alternative. I'm not going to say that I know that ultimately this is going to happen and we're going to, this is what we have to do to replace capitalism, or this is the answer or that's the answer. Because let's be honest here. I love railing against capitalism. And I love railing against the elites, and I do it on a weekly basis here. It's my soapbox. This is my soapbox here on Carson's Corner. But at the end of the day, I understand. I'm a realist. I understand that replacing the entire system in its entirety is a complicated thing. This is one of the things that the capitalists are very good at. Well, okay, Bob, you point out the problems with capitalism. We point out the great contradictions within the capitalist system, the great disparity between rich and poor, the social ills that accompany that. Well, what's your alternative, Bob? How do you replace the system? How do you basically put in place a perfect system to eradicate all these problems you speak of? And the answer is, it's not communism. The answer is a little bit more complicated, but I know, and that the system cannot continue the way it is. We need some sort of change. And we understand that by participating within the system, it is not yielding us any positive results. It's like Peter Joseph and the folks at the Zeitgeist Movement say, we don't have an economy, we have an anti-economy. You know, our GDP, gross domestic product, which, you know, many right-wing individuals use to justify extreme income inequality, it is considered by those in the Zeitgeist Movement as a measure of social degradation and industrial inefficiency. And I think that's absolutely correct. But you get the point there that the market system is inherently flawed. It is inherently anti-democratic. And as a result of that, and I are in a real pickle. I want to give a big shout-out to Thomas Baldwin, who is in our chat room. Thomas Baldwin is also part of the election boycott advocates. And Thomas, I know you have a blog out there. Thomas is a very, very good writer, and I'm hoping that we can have him on Carson's Corner in the future. A very, very wise man from Biloxi, Mississippi, and hopefully we can have some sort of collaboration. We can, maybe cross-promote, and well, I'm sure we'll have Thomas on to speak about the election boycott advocates group and as we move forward. But it's great to have political allies and individuals that have been active, you probably for a lot longer than I have. I mean, as I told you, I started getting involved with politics, and I have never voted, okay? And that's something, you know, when I was working on my undergraduate degree, people were just absolutely the idea that, oh, Bob, you have a political show and you haven't voted. And you know what? I'm glad that I haven't voted because I just how, you know, inefficient and ineffective elections are. And I'm glad I've never participated in an election. And as we move forward, come a corporate state, as, you know, corporate statism is all around us, it's going to become more and more apparent that elections are meaningless. And it's great to see people like Thomas Baldwin, Ted Aranda, Terry Lee, Christopher Alan Driscoll, and so many other election boycott supporters out there being active and getting the word out and, you know, converging. And that's what we have to do. So big shout out to Thomas Baldwin. Thanks a lot for listening out there, my friend. And, you know, hopefully we'll speak to you soon here on Carson's Corner. But, you know, we're talking about how essentially the Democrats are the more effective evil in advancing the corporate agenda. I was talking a little while about Bill Clinton and his role in the New Democrats and how financial deregulation to a large extent occurred on Bill Clinton's watch. And this was really in an effort to get Ken Lay into the banking industry. You recall Ken Lay, the deceased, I believe, CEO of Enron, who at one point had 800 shell companies, and he was looking to, you know, stuff profits in one area and losses in another, and just, you know, cook the books, so to speak, which has become, I think, commonplace for many of today's corporations. I mean, look at Wall Street, for crying out loud. You want to talk about cooking the books. You want to talk about a fraud in the appraisal realm. Well, look no further than Wall Street. And these individuals, Wall Street CEOs, Lloyd Blank, Fine, and the 63 CEOs that Obama put on this ridiculous deficit commission, they have not lost credibility. It's like Ralph Nader says, what do these people have to do to lose credibility? Well, this really, you can even go back to the Reagan administration with the deregulation of the SNLs. And this has really become commonplace among both political parties. In fact, not too long ago, I believe during maybe 4 or 5 years ago, but you could look during the Obama administration, President Obama has been a great deregulator in chief. Okay, the oil industry, the gas industry, President Obama bragged about, you know, cutting red tape. In fact, President Obama has actually gotten rid of more regulations than George W. Bush has. okay? And this is the guy that's supposed to be for the American worker. This is the guy that's supposed to be, he famously said in 2012 that, global warming is one of the most important issues of our time, right, or something to that effect. I don't have the exact quote in front of me, but, he gives great lip service to global warming, and yet what does he do after that? He golfs with a guy like Jim Crane, the owner of the Houston Astros, and this is a guy who's wired into the oil industry, owns an oil company or something to that effect. It's just to the extent that he's involved, and he makes money off of destroying our planet. Well, but that's what we have in President Obama. That's what we have right now in the Democrats. And so that's why it's important for us to focus on the more effective evil. And really, really important stuff. So, but that's why you can't support the Democrats, folks. That is why you have to realize that in the United States of America, Paul Street brings this up. He mentions Richistan, okay? And what Richistan is it's a term. It's basically a term developed, I believe, by Robert Frank. Robert Frank, I think, actually, oddly enough, worked for the Wall Street Journal, I believe. And it is a parallel country of the rich, okay? Now, we understand that the wealthy are not living in the same country as we are, okay? Capitalist owners have no attachment to the product that they put out. Look at someone like Mitt Romney. All right, good example of this. Mitt Romney, who ran in 2012, is probably going to run again. Most likely will win because the business community now wants somebody completely in their pocket. Both candidates are. But they want a corporate raider. They want a CEO in chief, as Mitt Romney is. Now, Romney and his company, Bain Capital, had no attachment whatsoever to the products they put out. They had no attachment whatsoever to the workers that they displaced in an effort to make a profit. In fact, I think you can make an argument that many has indirectly killed thousands of people. I mean, look at the human cost that Bain Capital has incurred upon our society. I mean, just it's unbelievable. But Mitt Romney's rich. He's a millionaire 100 times over who pays a lower effective tax rate than his secretary, most likely, pays a lower effective tax rate than an army captain or fill in the blank. He has no attachment whatsoever. But yet, what we see right now with people like Romney and others is that these people control so much of the nation's wealth. In fact, it is said that the very wealthy, the top 1%, those that are at the very top of Richistan, a parallel country for the rich, almost $2 trillion a year. They own almost $2 trillion a year, which is more than most nations. They have their own healthcare system. They have their own travel network. And they barely pay their own bills. And this is all in Paul Street's new book, They Rule, the 1% versus democracy. And with that massive amount of wealth and income comes political power. Power is how you get things done in our society. And so when you have someone that's making $1 million, $2 million a year, they're lower level of Richistan. They're not they're basically a minnow in the pond. I mean, yeah, if you're making $1 million a year, you're making more than 99% of the population. You have more money than you know what to do with, and that comes with a lot of political power. I mean, you could poll someone or you could question someone who's in the top 1% of income earners, and you'll see that these people have talked to politicians. They're wired into the business community of their town, okay? They're able to put aside moral qualms to meet the bottom line. And this is generally true of all rich people. But the super rich, I mean, the individuals I talked about earlier in the program, the first hour, 27,000 donors donating over $750 million to Barack Obama. Obama, according to Andrew Craig, received more private donations from Bain Capital than did his opponent in 2012. These people have all the political power. These people get to meet with politicians on a daily basis. And if you look at what they want done, you know, deficit reduction over job creation, a cycle of disinvestment, not putting public monies, not putting taxpayer money to anything that they don't want, privatization of our school system, the privatization of our roads. I've said it on this show before, folks, if they could privatize our organs, they would. If they could privatize the air we breathe, they would. They've already privatized the internet. You know, they're just on a massive privatization kick, because ultimately that's more money for them and that's more power for them. You know, these individuals are just killing us. They're absolutely destroying us. And it's we have to reach a point where in the United States of America, and this is what I was talking about earlier, reaching a new level of consciousness. In this country, we look at a billionaire being bad for society. We look at a billionaire as being fundamentally anti-human life, fundamentally anti-worker. He's a billionaire because, you know, thousands of people are poor. We have potentially a limited money supply in our country, and people do not have enough money to live, and yet this billionaire has $1 billion, presumably. Okay, however you want to cut it, however you want to slice it. That is evil, and we need to neutralize the billionaire, and we need to say, you know what? Billionaires are bad for society, just like corporate America. Corporate America, the wealth that corporate America has, I don't want to say earned, but has amassed over the past 30-plus years, has been the result of socially negative activities in our society. Paul Street, you know, talks about the socially negative activities spurred on by tax cuts. When you cut taxes for corporations, you cut taxes for wealthy people, you have a whole host of socially negative activities, mergers, you know, acquisitions, the destruction of labor, the acceleration of income to folks at the top. I mean, you could just go down the line. The, you know, gutting of campaign financials, everything to further the corporate state. Well, this is what is happening. This is where we're at in America right now. And it's really remarkable. I want to go to the chat room here, and I want to encourage everybody to visit Thomas Baldwin's blog. It's proactvoice.wordpress.com. proactvoice.wordpress.com. And he's got a great new blog, guest writer Matt Reedy, entitled Taking America Back. I want to encourage everybody, maybe we'll link up to that as well. I like to really link up with Thomas in the future, but I encourage you to read alternative forms of the media. Read non-corporate owned, non-corporate sponsored, non-corporate sourced media. It's very, very important. We're going to be right back after this brief timeout here, folks.
Hey, this is Frank Schaefer, author, writer, New York Times bestseller. But I'm here today because I've got a new book called Why I'm an Atheist Who Believes in God. And I'm also on Carson's Corner because corporate media is so one-dimensional in terms of the kind of things they cover that they couldn't comprehend a discussion that would begin with a statement that implies a huge paradox. But I think there's a lot of thinking people out there who understand that life is paradoxical, and Carson's Corner is one of those places you can discuss it. So thanks for being with us.
Hello, my name is Jim Gray, and I am a judge of the Superior Court in California and a former federal prosecutor in Los Angeles. I would like to talk to you for a moment about marijuana. Did you know that since the federal government first banned marijuana in 1937, usage in this country has actually gone up by about 4,000%? Or did you know that in the Netherlands, where adults are allowed to possess small amounts of marijuana and buy it from government-regulated businesses, fewer adults and fewer teenagers smoke marijuana than here in our country? Or that an American is arrested on marijuana charges every 38 seconds? If you are wondering if any of this makes sense, you are not alone. To find out more, contact the Marijuana Policy Project at 1-877-JOIN-MPP or visit them on the web at mpp.org. Thank you and good luck to us all.
This is Greg Pallas, reporter for BBC Television and Democracy Now! And author of the new book, Vulture's Picnic, In Pursuit of Petroleum Pigs, Power Pirates, and High Finance Carnivores. And you're listening to Carson's Corner on 5:30 a.m. Underground Progressive Radio, radio for the 99%. Help us occupy the airwaves and support Carson's Corner and support 5:30 Underground Progressive Radio.
Want to let we're back here on Carson's Corner. My name is Bob Carson, and I want to let people know that October 5th, from 5 p.m. to 9 p.m. at the National Black Theater in Harlem, there's going to be a Zeitgeist Media Festival, and I may attend this. This is a very, very important media festival, and it's going to be Sunday, October 5th, from 5 p.m. to 9 p.m. at the National Black Theater in Harlem. A good friend of mine, Harry Kaysen, who is a member of the Zeitgeist Movement, will be there. Harry Kaysen has been a guest on the show. He's also a professor, I want to say at CUNY. I'm not sure exactly, but I believe it's CUNY. And he's got a new book coming out, too, and he'll be on the program. And I want to encourage people to take a look at that, to participate, to look at some of the work published by the Zeitgeist Movement. Very, very important stuff by Peter Joseph and other contributors. And I know Peter Joseph teamed up with Lee Camp to produce the Culture in Decline videos. I consider Peter Joseph an intellectual authority. You know, we have intellectual authorities. I have intellectual authorities in my life. And many of the intellectual authorities that I have are authorities of yours. You know, for example, Ralph Nader. I consider Ralph Nader to be an intellectual authority. I read his work, and I've spoken about his work on a daily basis here. Paul Street is another guy. I've interviewed Paul Street. I've had him on this program before, and I think his work is just invaluable. I've been talking about his latest book, They Rule, the 1% versus Democracy, for quite some time now. Okay. I also consider Noam Chomsky to be an intellectual authority. Now, you know what's funny about all these guys? Now, these are intellectual authorities for people like me, wage slaves, proletarian individuals, people that have to rent themselves out to survival. Have you seen any of these guys on the corporate media? Have you seen Noam Chomsky on any of the Sunday shows? Have you seen Ralph Nader on any of the corporate media shows? Have you seen Paul Street? Of course not, ladies and gentlemen. Of course not, because these individuals are, by and large, marginalized because they do not reinforce the corporate state. They are absent. The media tells you that these people don't matter, so therefore they're not on television. They're not important because, you don't want to listen to what they have to say. They have nothing important to say. And this speaks to the lack of democracy that we have. You know, Noam Chomsky talks about how you can, in the United States, right, and this is how the elites get us to believe that somehow we're in a free country, right? Oh, we're the land of the free. Anybody can speak out against the government. Anybody could speak out against the economic system. Well, technically that's true. You know, I mean, anybody can get a blog, anybody can get a website and speak about the harsh conditions, the harsh realities of capitalism, And, yeah, you could do that. And technically nobody's going to arrest you. But once you start to make some waves, once you start to get people to notice you, then that's when the resistance comes from the full weight of the business community. Anybody that challenges capitalism, questions capitalism, is neutralized in many ways. And, you know, you could look at history, look at Malcolm, look at Dr. King. I was talking with a very well-educated man when it comes to Malcolm. I'm not going to tell you who he is, but he's also an intellectual authority that I personally know and was with the last few four or five days ago. And he's I wouldn't say he's a scholar on Malcolm, but he has done a lot of research about Malcolm. And he's actually friends with Malcolm's youngest daughter, who I've met at some gatherings. And, you know, I'm fascinated by Malcolm. And I've studied I haven't studied Malcolm a lot, but I'm going to start to – I want to read his autobiography. And I asked, well, why? Why was Malcolm killed? You know, what happened? And the general consensus is that Malcolm was killed because he was talking about, you know, capitalism. He was talking about worker solidarity, all the things that are in contrast to the goals of the elite. And that you look at certain trends in America, you know, and you could see people that are cut short from us, people that are assassinated, tend to always end up questioning capitalism. You know, Dr. King reportedly got very radical towards the end of his life and, you know, started talking about workers' rights and talking about, you know, unionization. He was famously shot while attending a union gathering. And that's you know, what you have in America. You know, you can't. People have been killed. People have been jailed. I mean, they're when it comes to questioning the economic system in America, there's no tolerance for that, none whatsoever. And that's why you don't have an Occupy protest anymore. You don't have an Occupy movement. Is there an Occupy movement? Can we honestly say there's an Occupy movement? No, absolutely not. It ceased to exist. It was broken up by the state. And in fact, it was broken up in large part by the financial sector, right? It was, you know, Wall Street was paying, you know, New York City police officers to pepper spray and brutalize the Occupy protesters, which is just such the irony is unbelievable. But you see what's going on here is that, you know, in the United States of America, there is no room in the current system for any type of dissent, any type of real analysis of capitalism. And that is why the aforementioned authorities, the intellectual authorities, are absent from the public discourse. They're gone. They're nowhere to be found. That is why we have no alternative, at least presented to the mass public, that questions the economic system, that questions capitalism, you know. And so we're generally absent from the discussion. And that's why it's so important to, you know, reject it. Reject the media. Reject the political system. I do. We all do. You know, it is inherently invalid. The individuals on the corporate media have no connection whatsoever to you and I. You can look at almost anybody, you know, anybody that's in any type of professional industry, anybody, a doctor, a lawyer, right, an accountant, particularly a media pundit, you know, a journalist, or fill in the blank. These individuals, for the most part, you know, there are exceptions to the rules, but for the most part, grew up in wealthy families. And you know, we're introduced to institutions that are not accessible to the working class. And there's a debate right now in the election boycott advocate group, which I'm currently being part of right now, about whether or not to include the working class into the platform, into the title of the group. Right now, the name of our group is the Election Boycott Advocates, and I think that's great. That's what it's always been. But we may end up incorporating the term working class in the name, and that is up for debate, and it's certainly a debate I want to have. And some people feel that it's alienating to put that in there, and this is a discussion. This is one of the great things about the group is that we can have a discussion. But at the end of the day, you know, I believe that if there is going to be a revolution, I believe that if things are going to change, it's not going to be from a yuppie like Chris Hayes over at MSNBC or, you know, Rachel the elitist Maddow, Rachel serving cocktail drinks at you know, Washington, D.C. Gatherings Maddow, having cocktails with Roger Ailes Maddow. It's not going to be from people like that. It's going to be from the downtrodden. It's going to be from people, you know, like myself, people like Brad Hulhut or any one of the occupiers that have nothing to live for. I mean, I hate to sound dramatic, but I'm not being, you know, dramatic here. I'm being honest here. You know, under the current economic system right now, it's those of us that have to rent ourselves out for survival, which makes up a majority of us, those of us that are just absolutely riddled with debt almost have no other recourse. It's like the conditions are so bad for us, and there's some solace in the sense that we know that we're not alone. I know I'm not alone. You know, I know that there are millions and millions of people out there that are like me, that are living paycheck to paycheck, that have too much debt that they can pay back, and that, you know, are just working dead-end jobs or renting themselves out for survival in a time where wages are down and corporate profits are up and inflation to whatever extent you think it exists is eroding our wages, and it's just the rich get richer and the poor get poorer. You know, we understand that, but that's what's going to really solidify change. It's people like us. You know, it's the people, the occupiers, the people that I mentioned, and there are other people out there, and so that's really important because, again, as the material conditions of capitalism deteriorate, there's going to have to be an alternative. There really is. I want to thank everybody in the chat room. I want to thank Christopher Allen Driscoll. We're not done yet. We still got about 9 minutes or so. And Ted Aranda of the Election Boycott Advocates, who joined us in the first hour. And we will be having a discussion, a weekly discussion here on Carson's Corner with the Election Boycott Advocates. We're going to update. We're going to rant, okay? You know, some people may not like the format, and I'm open to suggestions. But you know what? I have this show to rant, and that's what's important. I don't care if some people want to marginalize it, say it's a soapbox or this and that. Well, you know what? There's no other type of discussion like this. You know, you really, really can't find it. You really can't on the corporate media. I want to talk about, you know, we're kind of jumping around here, but it all fits into the narrative here that we have had for a long time, how, you know, the system is just corrupt and, you know, the economic system has just gone awry, is the idea that the United States of America is the land of opportunity, right? That, if you work hard, you could succeed in America. And this myth is reinforced in us on a daily basis. I mean, it's almost from the time that we're born. I mean, I can remember when I was young, when I was, you know, 5, even before that, 4 or 5 years old. You know what I was obsessed with at that time? Rocky came out, right? You had Rocky 1 in 1976. I think you had Rocky 2 in 1982, or and then you had Rocky 5. Rocky 4. I think Rocky 4 came out around 84, or 85, and it was I think the highest grossing Rocky movie. It was Rocky IV, and I was obsessed with it. You know, I had all the Rocky posters and the Rocky dolls. Now, it's a great story. It really is. It's a great movie. It's a very, very inspiring movie. But at the same time, it's a very politically motivated movie. You know, Sylvester Stallone, I consider Sylvester Stallone to be almost like a right-wing cult figure in Hollywood. I mean, I like Sylvester Stallone. I mean, I love, well, I don't want to say love, but I like some of his movies. You know, I've watched a lot of his movies. I can, you know, Copland, I can rattle off so many lines. It's great. But Rocky, I look at it as almost a political movie, you know, particularly the first one, but all the movies. And it just reinforces the idea that you can do anything, and that, you know, in the United States of America, anything's possible. Work hard and believe in yourself and this and that. Well, as Paul Street points out, the problem with that is the empirical evidence out there is just making that claim laughable. I mean, it's just how anybody can say that with a straight face anymore is just beyond me. I mean, I understand why they're doing it, but it's absolutely laughable. The idea, because what elites in our society, one thing that I've realized when it comes to everything, when it comes to welfare, when it comes to the, you know, incentive-based economy, you know, things like unemployment, when it comes to things like voting rights, the restrictive voting laws that have been taking place in Republican states, the exception always becomes the rule. And, you know, this is who is ruling the country, and this is what gets placed into law. You know, for example, you know, when Ronald Reagan gave his welfare queen speech, you know, this is a message that resonates with white America, but it's the exception. It's not the rule. Sure, there are people in society that don't want to work. You're never going to have full employment in any society. But these people, by and large, are the exception rather than the rule. Okay, most welfare recipients actually work. And you know, some of them work, you know, two jobs and whatnot. Same thing with, you know, there's been no voter fraud cases. You know, the Republicans have spent millions of dollars trying to look into this, and studies show it doesn't exist. And yet, you know, still, it's the exception that spurs the law. It's the perception becomes reality and whatnot. And so this is, you know, part of the reason why that we get sold the mobility myth out there. Oh, this is the United States of America, land of the free, home of the brave. The fact of the matter is that you are not free. The fact of the matter is that none of us are free. I don't look at myself as a free person at all. And you know, we should acknowledge that, really, is that, you know, you're not free. Your choices in life are limited by things, and those that are born into wealth, those that, you know, are just by no other reason, just luck, born into wealthy families, these people are going to have an easier time in life. They're going to have needs addressed. They're going to have more opportunities, and that's the type of, you know, society that we live in right now. And so if you agree with that, and if you study the evidence out there, and you realize that, okay, if you're born into the bottom portion of the income ladder, you have a 1% chance of getting to the top. It's, as Alan Krueger reports, the relationship between U.S. parents' income and what their children earn is like the relationship between the parents and children's height. And it's absolutely correct. The poor are born poor at the bottom of the ladder. They will stay there. It is an absolute fact. Now, we don't want to admit this because this is an indictment on capitalism, but it's the truth. So if you agree with that, if you understand that, then why do you continue to support the system? Why do you continue to vote for politicians who are not elected to change things, they're elected to keep things the same. And that is the question. That is really the question. All right, I'm out of time here. It's been great having you on board here on Carson's Corner. Again, big thanks to the election boycott first hour, Christopher Allen Driscoll, and Ted Aranda. I want to have these guys on, and I want to have many of you out there on each and every week supporting the election boycott advocate movement and supporting us and everything. And let's have this discussion. Let's have our little soapbox here. It's very, very important. I want to tell you that you could friend me on Facebook at facebook.com/ Bob Carson MMA. You could follow me right here on Twitter at twitter.com/ Bob Carson MMA. And please follow me on Blog Talk Radio, blogtalkradio.com/ Carson's Corner. Thank you very much. Also, support the commonsprojectnetwork.com and make sure to support Thomas Baldwin's site, proactvoice.wordpress.com, for great, great material, outside-the-box material. Make sure to bookmark that site as well. So that's it. I'm Bob Carson. Thanks for listening. And until next time, ladies and gentlemen, show some respect.